So this is in all probability the last talk, but you never know. And it's on Dana Paramita, the perfection of generosity, perfection of giving. I'm very conscious that I've approached this series of talks from a traditional point of view in rather a strange sort of way. The general approach would have been a bit different. First we looked at things, we had a kind of general overview of spiritual life, of the Bodhisattva path in terms of view, practice and fruit. I know some groups have been haven't got far beyond that particular triad, and I think that's interesting because I think there's an enormous amount to be gained from just exploring all that. Then we looked at the arising of the bodhicitta, opening up to things as they are, opening up to others. And those first two talks, you could say, were in a fairly conventional order. But then I went to Virya Paramita. I went there because kind of intuitively, or maybe I was sort of in tune in some level with the retreat, it seemed to me that important to talk about the importance of rousing our spiritual energy, our aspiration, our motive, our commitment. I said that sometimes they say that, you know, Virya is the most important of the paramitas because you need Virya in relation to all the other paramitas. Then I went back, as it were, to Sila, which is usually the second paramita. Having roused our motivation, we then had a look in detail at our conduct, and I spoke mainly there about the basis for conduct, the basis for ethics, the essence of ethics, in terms of the development of conscience and ethical sensibility, in terms of shame and sensitivity to the opinion of spiritual friends. Yesterday we looked at kshanti, we looked at patience, forbearance, and indeed the wisdom that's required to follow the Bodhisattva path. And today, which as I've said will probably be the final talk, we'll be dealing with what is at one and the same time the most profound and also the most basic of the paramitas, the most profound and also the most basic, the most elementary. Traditionally, Dana Paramita is listed as the first of the paramitas, the perfection of generosity. It's the most basic paramita. It's often listed also among the virtues and practices of those who cannot practice very much, the so-called laity, the people who aren't the full-timers, the monks. It's often said in the Theravadin Pali tradition that their practices are dana, sila and bhavana. Bhavana in the sense of meditation, in the sense of the development of calm, as opposed to Sila, Samadhi, Prajna of the monk. Well worth reading, actually, is Bhante's discussion of the Bodhisattva path, where he sees the six perfections as a sort of synthesis of Sila, Samadhi, Prajna and Dana, Sila and Bhavana. Thus the Mahayana bring together, present a path which is all-inclusive, which, as it were, transcends the distinction between the so-called monk and the so-called layman. But it seems to me the point is we might not be able to meditate, we might not be very ethically pure, we might not read the Buddhist scriptures, but you can always practice generosity. It's a sort of easy virtue. Yes, that's often meant in another context, isn't it? But it is a sort of easy virtue. We can be people of easy virtue by practicing dana. It's very easy to give money. As Bhante was once in a men's event, he was asked, you know, could you say something about how to give? And he said, oh, well, it's very easy. You just put your hand in your pocket and you take out the £5 note or the £10 note and you put it in the dana bowl. It's a very, very simple, not very complicated process at all. So it's very easy. It's easy to give a few pence to a beggar or something like that, or indeed in the dana bowl. It's fairly easy, actually, to give some of your time and energy. You might not be yes, a great meditator, but you can certainly give time and energy to organise a fundraising event at a centre or something like that. And of course, dana, in its very basic sense, is a very strong practice in the Buddhist East among ordinary people. Not just the Buddhist East, in India, generosity in this very basic way is everybody seems to practice it quite naturally. Giving seems to be part of those traditional cultures, and perhaps it's a part of any traditional culture. You see people quite naturally giving to beggars or being hospitable and so on. I've seen it so many times on train rides. I've experienced it and also witnessed it. You know, just people sharing their food and making sure that you're comfortable and things like that. Very, very naturally. Buddhists in India, I've experienced, really like to give money for the Dharma. Just ordinary people, people who aren't, you know, they're definitely Buddhists, but they're not necessarily fully committed to, you know, a full-time spiritual path. I remember having a very moving experience, very deeply touching and stirring experience in Nagpur. I was giving a lecture, and it was a particularly, you know, it was going well with my interpreter. Big crowd in the open air at night, and yes, we were particularly on fire, I think, that night, myself and my interpreter. And when the talk ended and I sat down, a young mother sitting with her child in the front row put something into his hand and just pointed to go and go up to the stage and give it to me. And it was 500 rupees. And she was obviously not a wealthy woman. I mean, that was quite evident. But extraordinary. 500 rupees is a lot of money for somebody on a low income in India. So it's a lot of money. I must admit, I felt suddenly an incredible responsibility. And I could see very easily how, you know, in a culture like that, you could really abuse, you know, the generosity of people. But she was obviously, and I checked out, you know, I said to the alderman, I said, look, is this okay? I mean, should we try and find a way of money, giving the money back? And they said, well, there's absolutely no question of that. I mean, she's very, very devoted to the Dharma. She's very devoted to our Sangha. And it would be terrible if you gave the money back, you know. And I said, she's okay, she's fine, everything's all right. But there it was, that wonderful, she was moved, she spontaneously wanted to give money for the furtherance of the Dharma. So it's in the culture, I find, in the East. Dana pervades Buddhist cultures. Lokamitra's experience is very strongly in Taiwan with Chinese Buddhists. Dana, paramita, they take very, very seriously. The Chinese community, and of course Chinese are very, very good business people, but a lot, they give so much of their surplus to the Dharma. Incredible amounts of money. And a lot of our buildings in India have come through the generosity of Chinese Buddhists. Very, very devoted. And it's a very important part of their practice. Behind it, no doubt, the whole culture of Dana is no doubt the notion of accumulation of punya, of merit. Dana leads to future happiness. And that's a very strong view in traditional Buddhist cultures, that dana leads to future happiness for oneself and for others. Sometimes that can be a bit mechanical, and I've certainly been on the end of, and I've witnessed, as it were, inappropriate giving, where you're almost forced to receive something because the person sort of wants something. But actually, and it's been quite insensitive, but actually, my general experience is that's been rare. My general experience among Buddhists in India is a very, very natural and positive generosity. And it creates, I think, a general positive and cheerful mood in people. It's not necessarily a very deep spirituality, but it creates, I think, a large-heartedness, a big-heartedness. People often in the West comment, certainly with our Buddhist friends in India, how cheerful they are. You can see that in Aniruddha. Naturally cheerful and buoyant. And I think this is one of the effects of a culture of generosity. It's one of the effects of that. Generosity expands you. At first, in the West, this is, we might be doing it more from an idea. You know, we encounter this idea of generosity, unless we come from perhaps a very generous family, or we're just sort of naturally generous somehow or other. But at first, it might be more of an idea for us as Buddhists. But the effect in time is to turn your focus away from yourself, which is, after all, only one part or portion of reality, towards other, to, you know, the other side of reality, if you like. I think practicing generosity, getting into the habit of that, tunes you in much more to other people, makes you much more expansive. You start to notice the needs of those around you much, much more. I must admit, I experienced this myself in relation to Bhante himself. I had a very, very strong experience of Bhante around the time at the time of my ordination. Spiritually, very, very strong. But then my relationship became a bit strange, and what it really boiled down to was I wanted attention from him. I wanted him to give me something. And it made things very strained, because my experience was that Bhante just, his response to that was to just ignore me for a number of years, which was extremely painful and puzzling. But he probably didn't really have a lot of choice in the matter. And, you know, he was a pretty tough sort of teacher. That's the way I experienced him, certainly, in those days. And there came a realization some years on that I hadn't actually given anything to Bhante in terms of an actual gift for him. And I started to just give him things. I'd go to a bookshop, a second-hand bookshop, and I'd see a book which I thought he might be interested in, and I'd buy it and give it to him. You know, just sort of bringing him things and things like that. And I noticed that my relationship with him started to change. You know, he was obviously pleased that, you know, I was showing an interest in him in this way. And there was a definite shift in our relationship. I started to relate to him, I think, much more as a person, rather than as this sort of spiritual, pseudo, you know, my idea of what a spiritual teacher should be, which would be to, you know, infuse me somehow or other with spiritual experience. And it definitely sort of shifted things on a bit. So I think a generous spirit, actually expressed in deeds, creates a wealthy, a rich attitude to life. A wealthy attitude is alert to possibility, to potential all around. I think a wealthy, generous attitude to life, you start having a sense of abundance and expansion. Even if you yourself are quite poor, you know, in terms of material things, you start to have a much more abundant approach to life. And you notice what the fullness of life a lot more. I remember Lala Taratna, who some of you will know, telling me a story about when he was a little boy, how his Irish uncles would come to stay, and they'd always give him a coin, which you don't have these days, called a half crown. Lovely big silver coin, beautiful coin, or a 10-shilling note. They were quite nice big notes, and you know, Lala Taratna always thought these uncles were rich. This expansive, you know, hand in the pocket, here you are, son, you know, have this. And then as he grew up, he realised they were really poor. They had hardly any money. But there was this lovely kind of expansiveness about them. And I think that that's a very, very beautiful quality. When we start talking like this, as generosity in terms of abundance, I think we're entering into the domain, the realm of Ratnasambhava, the rich, warm, yellow Buddha of the warm south, with his mudra of Varada, which is the mudra of supreme generosity, the completely open hand, open palm, completely egoless, selfless generosity. And Ratnasambhava is, of course, the Buddha of abundance and increase, and the yellow magic rite of prospering. So I think generosity creates this warm, abundant glow around the place. So on a very basic level, it would be good to consider our practice of giving and our feelings of generosity. Where are we at with that? Where are we at with generosity as a practice? Do we give in just an ordinary, straightforward sort of way? I mean, sometimes we can think in terms of, I'm giving, so much sort of mentally and psychologically to people, but just in an ordinary sort of way, just in terms of material help, in terms of actual things and our time and energy. And when we've given, how do we feel? Do we feel regretful? Or do we feel pleased and expansive? Do we have that sense of increase and expansion? I think it also might be worth asking ourselves, sometimes people struggle, with meditation and things like that. And sometimes, they think that it can be sorted out through, technical operations within the meditation itself. And of course, it's good to have a lot of tricks, as it were, within the practice itself to move things along. But it's very important that we look at what we're doing outside of the practice. And if we feel a bit, in metta bhavana, that there's not much going on emotionally, well, it might be worth looking at the quality of our dana, the quality of our generosity practice. Is that going on? So dana is very, very basic, and it's the first of the paramitas, the first of the perfections. Traditionally, this means that after the arising of the bodhicitta, the bodhisattva then practices dana. And it's a very interesting progression, this. Dana, in fact, is the expression of very deep and profound spiritual progress. Deep, profound spiritual progress is expressed through giving and generosity. Primarily, it's expressed in giving and generosity. Sometimes we think that spiritual progress will mean, it's all about having very profound meditations, very profound thoughts, and becoming very sort of sophisticated in our interactions with people. Well, it doesn't necessarily exclude those things, but in terms of how it manifests in reality, it's expressed as generosity. It's expressed as dana. Real spiritual progress happens when we begin to soften the distinction between self and other, when we begin to feel less separate. Real spiritual progress happens when excessive self-centeredness begins to drop away. When that happens, there's an expansion, there's a release of energy, and that's expressed as generosity. You don't think of things as yours so much. And this is, in fact, the real meaning of renunciation. Renunciation is not just giving things up in some sort of abstract way. You sort of, kind of give them up and sort of leave them behind. Actually, in the Mahayana, when they talk about renunciation, they speak of that as generosity. You give things away to someone. You pass things on. So when you soften self and other, there's this release of energy expressed as generosity. The experience of this is highly pleasurable. Highly pleasurable. One experiences great joy. And this is indeed the first of the bodhisattva bhumis, the stages in a bodhisattva's progress. The first stage is pramudita. And we've got a dhammachari called pramudita. He's a very generous and joyful person. Pramudita means simply the very joyful, and it's associated with the perfection of generosity. If you perfect generosity, if you're perfecting generosity, you're on the path of great joy, of excessive joy and happiness. Shantideva in the Bodhicharyavatara expresses this very, very strongly in his verses. He's clearly amazed at the bodhicitta, at the arising of the bodhicitta. He's amazed at this wonderful thing that he's found, like a blind man finding a jewel in a heap of filth. It's such a wonderful thing. And he's just so moved by that, and he feels so grateful at that, that he just praises the bodhicitta and worships the Buddhas. In very beautiful verses, he offers them everything. He offers them himself, his possessions, his body, his speech and mind. He offers all the good things that he can conceive of in his imagination. And really, though, he's just offering himself up totally to the Buddhas. He even says, in devotion, I offer myself as your slave. If that word slave is a bit strong, you can change it to, in devotion, I offer myself as your servant. He offers himself up, in other words, to the bodhicitta. He just wants to serve the Buddhas, which means, of course, serving others. The expression of that is serving others, becoming the servant of all, entering into the life of selfless service to others, which means the practice of generosity. I think it's very important to reflect on all this. When we come along to the Dharma, inevitably we do so for our own needs. Maybe we do have an altruistic streak, but even our altruism probably won't be completely pure. You know, we probably, you know, if we've been involved in doing things in the world, there might be other things involved, like status and desire for fame and all that sort of thing. When we come along, we come along because we're unhappy, or we have problems in our lives, or we want to know the meaning of life. We even might come along with the idea of gaining enlightenment for all, but basically even doing that for ourselves. Whatever, we're doing it for us, to sort ourselves out. Now, the motivation of sorting ourselves out is not a bad motivation. It's an inevitable motivation. It's an inevitable motivation. That's why we start. Spiritual life starts with dukkha. And Buddhist spiritual life demands a lot of introspection and reflection. Meditation practice is of very great importance. Ethical observance is very important because, and real ethics, Buddhist ethics, means looking at yourself very deeply. There's great emphasis placed on study and reflection. So there's great emphasis on going into ourselves, and we even read about the great yogis and hermits spending years in the wilderness in solitary meditation, meditating, and only afterwards, after gaining enlightenment, going out to others. And because of all this, we can begin to conceive of spiritual life in very self-referring terms. It's just about us. It's about insight and wisdom for us. Now, of course, meditation and introspection are of very great importance. We need to do a lot more meditation and introspection. No question about it. We need to go on retreats of all kinds, and even spend, when we're ready to do it, long periods on retreat, either alone or with others. If we really want to benefit others, we need substantial spiritual qualities which come from the kind of practices I've mentioned. However, I think we also need to take great care that the more introspective aspects of Buddhist practice don't become another version of self-centeredness. We can become over preoccupied with our mental states to a point which becomes actually an obstacle to spiritual growth. I've seen people get so caught up with their internal workings that they just get lost and confused. And they would be far better off if they looked outward, if they looked towards practicing generosity in relation to others, if they looked at what needed to be done around them, they looked at the needs of other people. If they could become a bit more generous, they might well start to shift the internal confusion. Apparently Dada Rinpoche was once asked, well, what do you do if you're not sure what to do? And he said, go and give something to somebody, or go and help somebody, or something like that. Then you can be sure you're on the right path, if you're actually generous in an ordinary sort of way. I sort of experience this sometimes with... Sometimes it has happened on going for refuge retreats, especially if I've been on retreat a long time, leading a lot of study, back-to-back retreats or something like that, and I've been seeing people and, you know, lots of other things going on. Sometimes before the study group, feeling an enormous resistance to going to the group. Maybe the group's not been going too well. Tremendous resistance and getting into a sort of conflicted, confused sort of state. But of course, you've got to go along because people have paid their money. They're all waiting and you feel a strong sense of duty to go. And then after only 5 or 10 minutes, the state of mind is completely changed. I don't feel confused. I feel completely clear. And by the end of the group, wondering what on earth the problem was to do with. And if I'd stayed in my room and avoided it, I would have just got into a very, very confused and conflicting state. So I think this need to actually engage with the world around us, particularly through practicing generosity, this is why I think in the early days of the FWBO, Bhante placed so much emphasis on dana. Particularly in the form of working for the Dharma, raising funds, building centres, and all the things that go with that, you know, running businesses and all those things that actually still indeed go on. In those days, we were all a lot younger, of course. And he was pointing, I think, to the need for us to relate to the objective world, as well, of course, serving the need of establishing environments in which others, many others, could actually practice. I'm going to actually do quite a long reading now. I'm going to give you a little bit of a glimpse into what it was like to be on seminar with Bhante. This is from the Mind in Buddhist Psychology seminar, a very famous seminar that got turned into Know Your Mind, which I attended. I actually transcribed this, and it was a really difficult thing for me when Bhante brought this up. The context of it was, earlier on that summer, the long hot summer of 76, Bhante had talked about the greater mandala of uselessness, of aesthetic appreciation. He says, you know, Bodhisattva, you know, he sees things as they are, so he doesn't have any kind of utilitarian approach to things. So he's in this kind of useless space. His work is within this, you know, all the great practical things he does is in this context of the open dimension, a completely the aesthetic quality of everything. And some people interpreted that as Bhante saying we don't need to do anything, because he did say do nothing. It's a very positive thing to do nothing and just appreciate doing nothing. That's a very good and important practice. And order members were coming back saying, well, we don't need, you know, to work in our centres and run our centres and all the rest of it. It's the way some people interpret it. When you actually look at the fine print in the seminar, he wasn't saying that at all. So we turned up on this seminar thinking that we were going to get more of that kind of teaching. But anyway, here's a little something for you. So first of all, Bhante. There are one or two points that I would like to make connected with this whole question of the psychological and the ethical. I was thinking about this in connection with that phrase of Gunther's, I don't know what Sanskrit or Tibetan term it translates, what he calls bi-tendential value of being, being with a capital B. What do you think he means by that? Going two ways? Yes, that's pretty good. Samsara and Nirvana? No, it's being with a capital B. You have transcended, apparently, the level of conflict. Wisdom and compassion? Yes, wisdom and compassion. That is, or rather, those are the bi-tendential value of being. But how exactly do they come in? It is as though the psychological has reference to oneself, the ethical to another. Not that the two are completely exclusive. You also come into the picture when there is a reference to another. But why is it that we even think and speak in terms of self and other, subject and object? It's because of this basic, original, and so far as ordinary experience goes, irreducible dichotomy of self and other, of subject and object. It is within the framework set up by this dichotomy that the whole of our experience and the whole of our thought takes place. But according to Buddhist philosophy, for want of a better term, and especially according to Mahayana philosophy, There is, in what Gunther calls being, in the realm of ultimate reality, no subject-object division. It's as though on the level of empirical reality, on the level of ordinary experience, you need a double approach. Reality has bifurcated into subject and object. So you are to approach reality not only via the subject, but via the object. In fact, in a sense, the best way to approach the bitendential reality is via the object rather than via the subject. Because to do things via the subject, as it were, is your natural one-sided tendency. It was really going into this. Even if you approach what you consider to be being, it is still just you approaching. The approach still takes place within the basic subject dichotomy. You are still doing something for yourself, which is a contradiction in terms. So, therefore, the altruistic approach is as necessary as the self-regarding approach. You are sort of making a two-pronged attack on being. You have, as it were, to gain being, not only for yourself, but for others. Otherwise, you do not gain being, not only for your, otherwise you do not gain being at all, because you cannot. It is only you plus others who can. So when you plus others, when you plus others attain being, that is the bitendential value of being which has been realised. Prajna representing your attainment and Karuna representing their attainment. If you approach the non-dual being from the standpoint of subject, your experience culminates in prajna. If you approach from the standpoint of the other, your experience culminates in Karuna. And these two coalesce. They form one value of ultimate reality. Hence, the bitendential value of being. To put it very simply and practically, it is not enough just to sit there in your meditation, feeling all nice and unselfish. You've actually got to go out and act unselfishly, which brings in the ethical, the other-oriented dimension. It is that only which will break down the barrier, as it were, between subject and object. That is why Shantideva speaks in terms of the exchange between the self and the other. You have to treat the other as the self, because what is the difference between them? You quite literally cannot realise being by yourself. That isn't even a possibility. This is what the Bodhisattva sees when he gives up the idea of individual nirvana. There is no nirvana for me as distinct from a nirvana for them. It was really, you know, he was really on a roll. So then somebody says, and there's no possibility of going it alone? No. Or going on your 6-month solitary retreat and realising being? A solitary retreat can certainly help you in the direction of being, but not if you think that you are doing it just for the sake of yourself. Hence the dedication of merits at the end of every spiritual act. Now some people might say, well, how can you work for others when you don't know what's good for them? But the same applies to you. How can you work for yourself when you don't know what's good for you? If we think in terms of doing it all for my sake, my development, my spiritual life, etc., we are not really breaking down that basic dichotomy between subject and object, which is all that really stands in our way. We are just sort of refining and refining one side of the dichotomy. So this is, in a way, what the Bodhisattva ideal is all about. If we're not careful, if we give too much value to what I call the psychological and not enough to the ethical or the other regarding, the spiritual life becomes a sort of refined pseudo-spiritual aestheticism in which you are concerned with increasingly more refined experiences just for your own sake. You might even become resentful of other people intervening and interfering with your enjoyment of or devotion to these refined experiences. It's a tough teacher, Bhante. Where will that eventually lead that person? Bhante, to a nirvana, laughs, if there was such a kind of nirvana. So it does lead. No, it doesn't lead anywhere, except to this increasingly refined pseudo-spiritual aestheticism. I think we have to be really careful about this. This is why the objective, other-regarding aspect of work and activity is so good for people. Even if you don't like doing it particularly well, never mind. So much the better in a way. It's great, isn't it? Here's another one. Here's a question. In the case of working for the movement, even if you hate it quite a lot, should you start, should you sort of carry on? Bhante, perhaps one should ask, first of all, what is one hating? What is it one is hating? And then the next person says, it may be quite simply that you're not really suited to that kind of work. Well, what does that amount to? What does that mean? Suppose it's, say, sweeping the floor at the centre. Well, what does one mean by saying that I am not suited to this? Or, this isn't suited to me? Does it mean anything more than, I don't like doing it? If you're asked to do an electrician's job and you don't know anything about electricity and you don't want to blow the place sky high, well, all right, you could say that. You are not a suitable person for the job. Fair enough. But if it's some simple, basic, practical thing that any fool could do, then why does one not want to do it? Does one think one could be doing better things? If you are doing it for the good of others and thereby breaking down the barrier between self and others, what could bring you nearer to enlightenment more quickly than that? Laughter. Assuming, of course, that one has stated explicitly that one wants to evolve, which means essentially that one wants to overcome the subject-object dichotomy and realise the bi-tendential value of being, and assuming that was all agreed upon and perfectly clear between all concerned. I think there is something to be said, for instance, for having to do things within the context of family life. I know such a statement can be twisted. I know I'm going to be quoted out of context, but never mind, I'm going to take that risk. Leaving aside rationalisation, sometimes it is said that the person who has domestic responsibilities and so on has to think about others in a way that perhaps those who don't have those sort of responsibilities don't have to. Well, true, there is a hard grain of truth in this. Do you see what I mean? It's all right to give up all such responsibilities, you know, when you are an ethical being, fully capable of fulfilling them and willing to fulfil them, but just refusing to consider the taking on of any responsibility, not just of this kind, but of any kind whatsoever, in the interest of your own so-called spiritual development, seems to smack, if one isn't careful, of the psychological, in the narrow sense that I've been talking about. So I think it isn't a bad thing for somebody involved in the spiritual life to take on a definite, concrete responsibility, with a centre, for instance, or a community, or a particular project. I think it would be quite dangerous for the average person to be left sort of floating without any kind of responsibility at all. There are people who can get on, say, with painting by themselves. Well, that's fine, because in most cases within the movement, the painting too is for the sake of others, especially in the case of those who are producing tankers and so on, to help others with their visualization practice. In such a case, you may need to work alone, even live and work alone, but provided you have the interest of others in mind, provided you are aware of some responsibility towards them, then you don't necessarily have to live in a community or work in a centre. Do you see what I'm getting at? So, quite strong stuff. But I wanted to read that. I mean, in part, to just give you a bit of a flavour of what it was like to be with Bhante. If you want to know where it happened, it was in the lounge in the house. And I can remember on that seminar, I started sitting next to Bhante at the beginning of it. By the end, I was as far away as I could be from him because it was all very intense. It sounds very strong, actually. He there's a great deal of humour in Bhante's exposition as well. So he wasn't like an Old Testament prophet, which you could get that impression from the way I'd read it. So it doesn't say that you don't meditate, you don't go on solitary retreat, but recognise what you're doing. Have a context in which for that to happen in. And I'm very glad that he emphasised this personally. When I was first involved, I think I kind of wanted to go off, you know, into retreat for long periods of time. I did do some long, you know, 1 month long solitaries quite regularly. But to be honest, if I tried a long solitary meditation retreat, I don't personally think I would have got very far. As much as anything else, involvement with others, responsibilities and the responsibilities that go with that have been essential to me, for maturing, just growing up, basically. And it's very interesting what he said there about involvement with family. Some years after that seminar, about 10 years later, when I was contemplating my next move, I'd been living in a particular centre for quite a long time. And Bansi said, "Well, what do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, I thought I'd just, you know, carry on here." And he said, "I don't think that's a good idea. Young men, single men, have to be very careful that they grow up. And there is this emotional immaturity that has been noticed, meaning me." And he said, "You know, married men with families, you know, they have to mature because they have to take responsibility for others. So you've got to really take great care that you take responsibility. I'm not saying you should get married." He made that very clear. He said, "You can if you want to. But you should really take something on. You could be a hermit. You could start a centre. You could, but really, whatever it is, make sure you take it on and you don't drift." Very, very strong. Very, very strong indeed. And I'm very, very glad he said that to me. Very, very glad he said that to me. The importance of committing myself, of giving myself to a particular project, to other people. So the practice of generosity in this broader sense is about relating to others, regarding yourself as having duties to others. You start to feel that others are your people, your community in a wider sense. And I think that's so important, not just in the development of spiritual qualities, it's part of human development and human maturity, human maturing. And it seems to me that our times are running counter to that aspect of things, as far as I can see. Spiritual growth is seen so often purely in terms of personal development. It's become a sort of adjunct to one's lifestyle. Buddhism seems to even have this image in modern Britain. I was listening to a program of some Western academics, experts in Eastern religion, talking about Buddhism in the West, and they talked about Western Buddhism as lightweight Buddhism. Buddhism is just a lightweight affair. You have a bit of meditation in a nice, safe, personal environment. Obviously, they can't be that aware of what we're trying to do in the FWBO, I presume. And I'm sure they're not aware of many other Buddhists in the West and what they're trying to do. Trying to recreate a positive sense of community, and trying to develop an environment where there are very, very strong relations with one another and all the duties and generosities that need to go with that. Communities trying to interact positively beyond themselves as well. But I find it sad that Buddhism has that sort of image as something you can sort of dip in and out of and not take very seriously, something that you just, you know, just fits in, you know, with a bit of Reiki this week, a bit of Buddhism next week, a bit of Sufism the week after, a bit of shamanism at the weekend, and so on. I'm not saying that all those things are bad or anything like that, but it's a shame if Buddhism has this kind of image, I think. So Dana Paramita for us, I think, goes beyond having a purely personal Dana practice. That's very important, the individual, the personal practice of us actually giving things to one another and giving things to people. I think Dana Paramita is also about working together and organising ourselves so that we can benefit more and more people, involving ourselves in that to the extent that we can. I'm not saying that everybody should be involved in this full time. I'm very aware in speaking to you that many of you have family responsibilities and lifestyles which are very important to you, which whereby you don't want to work full time, you know, for the Buddhist movement. But we can all, in different ways, contribute to establishing the Dharma in the world, and that's what the order has come together as a spiritual community. But there is a very strong vision coming from Sangharakshita that our practice needs to open out in relation to the world. And the FWBO, in the broadest sense, is simply about organising ourselves so that we can do that better. In a way, it doesn't matter how much or how little we do. But it's important that we all see ourselves, feel ourselves to be part of that process of bringing the Dharma into the world, which will mean, probably, making some sort of contribution. And of course, that will benefit us as well as benefiting the world. Buddhist tradition tells us that giving the Dharma to others is the greatest possible gift. It's greater than the gift of possessions, even vast quantities of money. Of course, money is very important to us. It's even greater than the gift of fearlessness, giving people confidence and reassurance, which is a wonderful, miraculous thing to give someone. It's even greater, giving of the Dharma, it's even greater than the gift of life and limb. What a thought that is. I can't imagine being willing to give my life for others. Instinctively, you could perhaps imagine it in an extreme situation, but even then it's hard to imagine. But, you know, imagine just with the coolness of thought, you know, deciding, okay, it's better that I die here for the sake of others. I can't imagine doing that, so attached and self-centered I am, and because how precious life is to me. But it's said that the gift of Dharma is even greater than all that, because if you give the Dharma to others, you're giving them the means to liberation, to a really deep satisfaction and to realization. You're giving them the possibility of realization. And of course, if you can give the Dharma to one or two people or more people, it means that that Dharma can spread more and more widely, so that more and more can become liberated. So giving the Dharma is regarded as the greatest possible of gifts. But giving the Dharma, if you're going to give the Dharma, you need to know the Dharma. You need to have studied the Dharma deeply. You need to have practiced the Dharma deeply. You need to have a real feeling for the Dharma. You need as well to know others. You need to be able to tune into others. I mentioned in Shila Paramita this aspect of a Bodhisattva Shila called Chittanuvartana, the ethics of empathy, the ethics of tuning into others, which it's said that a Bodhisattva in practicing this knows, senses the conditioning, the kind of forces that are going on in someone. He knows their character, their particular temperament and personality, their particular type. And so he knows precisely what yana, in other words, what course of spiritual practice to give to them. So you need to train a lot to truly give the Dharma in this way. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. But we can give the Dharma, and we can be part of giving the Dharma more modestly. And it's a really great gift to be involved in this more modest giving of the Dharma. We can help create the conditions whereby the Dharma can be given. We can help with the running of centres. We can help to open classes in different places, even open a class ourselves if there's no class in our time. Just modestly passing on what you know, being aware of your limitations, but you know, if you've been meditating for some years, you can probably pass on something about the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana. Obviously, doing that with discussion with the order members, you know, and making sure you sort of part, you know, you don't get out of your depth. We can help with the creation of funds to communicate the Dharma. We can help with the creation of resources to give the Dharma. I think it's very important to reflect and notice the effects of people giving in this way to for us, for our benefit. Sit in this magnificent shrine room in this wonderful place called Padmaloka. Well, Padmaloka is the heir to an incredible amount of generosity. People, you know, giving their lives really to create Padmaloka, and we are the recipients of that generosity. I'm very conscious of Dharma Priya being here and our German friends being here. Well, I know very well from his reports in Shabda and talking to him the incredible giving that Dharma Priya and Dharma Loka did in the early days of establishing the FWBO in Germany. It really wasn't easy at all. They really had to kind of go against the grain in themselves sometimes to establish that. Now, I'm saying this not to, you know, make us feel, you know, bad and, you know, that, oh, I don't give enough, or shame us or anything like that. It's to point out that, you know, the practice of the Dharma that we have, the world of the Dharma that we inhabit, has come out of people's generosity. And if there's going to be a future for the Dharma in the world, it will happen through people giving themselves to the support of the Dharma, to the spread of the Dharma. And we do need to do more of it. Absolutely no question. We do need to do more of it. The world is hungry for Dharma. I think if we just reflect on, you know, how much we benefit from having the Dharma available to us, well, imagine, well, there's loads of other people who were like us all those years ago. And yes, it can be a very humble thing. I don't think it has to be, you know, we have to think of ourselves doing sort of superhuman, supernatural feats of Dharma, of Dana. I think it's more a matter of coming together with others and just quite steadily and methodically helping to provide the conditions for the Dharma to shine. I remember once being in India at our retreat centre at Bhaja, and I went up to the caves one day, the Bhaja caves, where there's a big stupa. Lovely old, ancient, they're the oldest caves in India, they think. This lovely old Chaitya Hall, this stupa at the end. And then, just away from that, there by the monks' dwellings, there are all these little stupas. And I was standing there, and I got into quite a sort of, you know, kind of poetic sort of mood. I was doing a lot of Dharma teaching in India. And just started to, you know, sort of feel the presence of these stupas and wondering who were the great bodhisattvas and spiritual heroes whose relics were in these stupas, you know, who was I sort of kind of linking up with? And I thought, well, maybe they weren't incredibly famous teachers. I mean, maybe they weren't like that at all. Maybe they were quite ordinary people like me who just felt devoted to the Dharma and who did their bit to transmit the Dharma and keep it alive. And I felt, you know, started to get into a mood of just rejoicing, if you like, in the ordinary efforts of ordinary people to keep the Dharma alive. We don't have to... Yes, it's great that there are the great saints and so on in Buddhist tradition, but they're very hard to emulate, very hard to emulate. But there's lots and lots of Buddhists. There's ordinary people who've given themselves, given their lives for the transmission of the Dharma, and we are their heirs. So being involved in this transmission, this giving of the Dharma, we are perhaps practicing a particular Dharma door, a doorway into the Dharma that Vimalakirti talks about. He talks about the inexhaustible lamp. And he gives this to teaching to Mara's daughters. Mara's daughters, he's tricked Mara, and Mara's daughters have been given to him, Vimalakirti, but Mara wants them back. He's very upset, and Vimalakirti, being very compassionate, says, okay, look, you better go back. You better go back with him. And they're very disappointed because these beautiful maidens want to be with Vimalakirti. He's far more groovy than Mara. So they say, how do we practice Dharma? How do we practice Dharma in the realm of Mara? He says, you practice through the Dharma door of the inexhaustible lamp. It says, a lamp, one lamp, can light so many other lamps. And it grows brighter if it lights all those other lamps. It doesn't diminish at all. The light grows ever stronger. So when you're in the realm of Mara, practice the transmission of the lamp. Light the other lamps around you. Then the Dharma will grow ever brighter. Well, Mara is extremely, excessively strong in this day and age. I mean, we've really increased the doorways into sensual desire and all the rest of it. It's always been there, but with technology we've made Mara's realm even more secure than ever. And we strengthen our own Dharma practice. We make the Dharma grow stronger through putting others, to the extent that we can, into touch with the Dharma by lighting the lamp of the Dharma in as many, many people as we possibly can. It's interesting using this image of a lamp and flame, because there has been in recent years an atmosphere of doubt and criticism around about working for the Dharma, contributing to the Dharma, working for the movement. People have wondered if it's actually worked, and people have said, well, look at all the people who've burnt out, and so on, in giving themselves. Personally, I've no regrets whatsoever about working within the FWBO. Sometimes it's been very, very hard indeed for me, as I know it has been for many of my friends. It sometimes involved very, very long hours of working, and sometimes it's been in very, very difficult situations. You know, I lived as part of the whole Croydon scene in the bad days. We worked extremely hard at that time. But I've got no regrets. I've got regrets about unskillful things I've done, sure. But I've got no regrets about my sincerity and motivation, if you like, and about the good things I've actually done. And I don't think any of those good things that I've done and the efforts that I've made have been wasted at all. The good that I've done, coming from a good motive, has not been wasted at all. There has been in it all an aspiration, a motivation towards bodhicitta. And where that's been there, that's never lost or wasted. Even on a practical level, it's been my experience. Sometimes when you hear the word Croydon, it's as if it was just all bad. Well, that's just not true. I worked very, very hard in Croydon and worked through some very dark periods. But there were people, somebody came to me who was just ordained recently and said, Pamavadra, do you know you were the first person to teach me meditation in Croydon? And now look, I'm an order member. And I thought, well, there you are. There you are. And there's been so many examples of that from those times. So our motivation, if it's a good motivation towards bodhicitta, that motivation and the efforts coming from that motivation are never wasted, even though appearances give another picture. I can remember doing classes sometimes where there were just two people. You'd advertise for a course, two old ladies, literally two old ladies would come along. And you think, oh my God, you know, what are we going to do? But they wanted the Dharma. You taught them the Dharma, even though it was 6 weeks of, pouring yourself out, feeling very tired sometimes at the end of it, or sometimes, people coming along and it all seems very bright, and then next week they're not there. They're not there. But I look back and at all these things and feel that no, my efforts weren't wasted at all. There is a basic Buddhist principle. Skillful action leads to increase, regardless of what's going on, physically around you. Within you, there is an increase. There is an increase of positivity. There is an increase of ethical motivation. Aspiration to bodhicitta leads to the growth of bodhicitta. It strengthens the bodhicitta not just in you, but in the world around you. In the world at large, the bodhicitta is growing. So practicing Dharma Paramita, you align yourself with the good, with the bodhicitta that's actually going on throughout the world. Not just, among other people in our Sangha, not just with other Buddhists. It aligns you with other people, people who've never even heard of bodhicitta, but who are aware and kind and live from that. Sometimes living from that very intensively and heroically indeed. So we align with them. And I must say, I hope that we can strengthen and intensify people working, as it were, within the institutions, as they're called. I don't like that word, of our movement. But I'm also very glad that our Sangha has a greater range than ever before. I'm very glad that there are doctors and nurses and artists and poets and social workers and therapists and teachers and so on. I'm very, very pleased about that. I like to know what they do. I want to hear about how they affect the world for the better. I find it moving and inspiring to hear that. I'm very glad of that because it aligns me with the motivation towards bodhicitta throughout the world. And I'm very glad that our Sangha includes more and more nationalities. It's very moving that the Dharma is widening and growing throughout the world. So I feel it's very important that we all feel part of this process. It's all too easy to lose heart, to think that we make no difference. But we do. We really do make a lot of difference. The smallest of things can lead to so much. There's a story of an order member who was travelling around India many years ago, and he bought some deep-fried vegetables, you know, bhajias as they're called, from a roadside seller. I think it was in Sarnath. And you know, he ate the bhajis, and then he started. And as often happens in India, it was wrapped in a page of newsprint from an old magazine, and it was a page from an FWBO newsletter. A page from an FWBO newsletter, which he read, and was inspired by, and that got him involved in the Dharma. That started the whole process of him getting involved. So, someone wrote an article. They made the effort. Maybe it was a big effort. In those days, it was probably a very big effort to write an article. Somebody edited that newsletter. Somebody, you know, put it together. Somebody wrapped it up in the envelope in those days and sent it off to Sarnath. And maybe at the time they were thinking, why are we doing this? You know, why are we bothering to send these out? And by strange, you know, routes and byways, it came to someone, you know, who needed it in India. So it's the little things, the little dharmas, that can lead to so much. It might seem, oh, you know, so going back to working in Croydon, you know, working as a waiter on tables. I mean, there were a couple of guys who used to come in regularly. And, you know, they'd come in to have a meal every week, and, you know, you think, you'd never have thought that they'd get involved with the Dharma. You know, eventually they came to the centre, and now they're order members. So it might seem that what you do is so small and so insignificant. What you do is so insignificant. But who knows what vibrations and movements are being set in motion through that simple act of dana. So much can flower from that seed. It doesn't matter how small or how humble we feel. All of us have something to give, something to contribute right now to the growth of bodhicitta in the world. And we need to strengthen that. Now this aspect of things, I think, is brought out, this way of responding, thinking in this way, is brought out in a particular meditation practice called the development of the bodhicitta. In a way, I regard it increasingly as a dana bhavana, a cultivation of generosity practice. There are many forms of the practice, but I'll just describe one of those forms. You contemplate, you first of all begin with metta bhavana. You get into a good positive state, and then you intensify your motivation, your aspiration towards bodhicitta, to gaining enlightenment for all beings. You might even bring to mind, you know, a Buddha or bodhisattva to particularly inspire you. You can even then imagine that metta and that aspiration as a sort of ball or sphere or pearl or jewel in your heart, as though your heart has become that. And then you imagine around you all beings, all people, people you know, your mother, your father, your family, your friends, your relations, your brothers and sisters in the Sangha. You imagine your enemies, people you don't have any particular feeling for. You imagine especially those who are in states of suffering, people you know especially who are suffering. Of course, everyone is suffering in one way or another in the world. You contemplate that. You contemplate that suffering. In fact, you visualize that as a great black cloud, a thick black cloud that rises up off of this sea of beings, and then you breathe in that black smoke. You breathe it into that sphere of light that in your heart, and as soon as it hits that white light, you breathe out from that sphere, you breathe out that white light, and you imagine that white light falling on all beings, cool like moonlight, cooling their suffering. Or you imagine it as nectar falling upon them, just alleviating their pain, taking away their pain, bestowing all good things upon them, even enlightenment itself, great bliss itself. And you just keep doing this, you know, for as long as you can, breathing in the black smoke of other suffering, breathing out the white light of happiness, of generosity, and raining that down on them. You just keep doing that. Usually we try to avoid suffering. Somebody was saying to me the other day, it was Art of Prayer, it was something that I do. You know, we open a newspaper and, you know, sometimes you're just confronted with this suffering and you quickly turn over. It's just too much to bear. It's hard to take it in. You almost feel sometimes obscene to even look at it. But here in this practice, you move towards it. You become more aware of it. But you move towards it with your aspiration. If you like, you relate your aspiration to this suffering. You open up to this suffering. You take it in. And the more you take it in, the more you respond. The more you take it in, the more you can give. It's said that in this practice, when you breathe in the smoke, it actually makes this light of aspiration in you even stronger. So the more you take in, the more you give. The more you give, the more you can take in. So that's why I think of it as a dana bhavana, this practice. It's a strong practice, of course, and some Tibetan masters regard it as the most tantric of all practices. After you've done this breathing meditation, breathing in the smoke and breathing out the light, you then have to kind of return. It's best to return to that state of metta and even start to move to mudita, joy, of rejoicing in the good that's around, the good in you, the good in others, looking for the good all around. There isn't just suffering, there's also a great deal of good that needs to be rejoiced in. And of course, you do that in case you just end up becoming miserable, which isn't the aim of the practice. And at the end of all this, you let it all go. You just let whatever you've been doing, you just let it all go. You occupy an open, a kind of undefined sort of state, so that you start opening up, in other words, to emptiness, to shunyata, to the voidness of all things. So that's a very, very good practice, which can help with dana paramita. True dana paramita takes place in the Trimandala Parishuddha, the threefold circle of purity. This is the perfection of generosity, in which there is no perception of a self, no perception of a gift, and no perception of the person you're giving to. As the Diamond Sutra says, you're giving unsupported by a sign. You're giving, although perhaps you can hardly even call it giving, because how can you give if there's no self and other and gift? There is just, as it were, a flow of creative activity, an easy, effortless flow of energy ever renewing itself. This is the end of dana. This is what we need to be aiming for. For a bodhisattva in tune with the nature of life, Bhante says, giving is innate. We are innately void, innately pure, innately generous. We may release our innate generosity when we also realize our innate voidness. If to be a bodhisattva is natural, to practice dana is natural. Amazing passage from Wisdom Beyond Words. So this is our aim, for our dana to be natural, our generosity to be an expression of how we see things. And this is what our practice will become if we follow the bodhisattva path. And it begins with our own efforts, with our simple acts of dana, our acts of kindness and awareness and intelligence, which we gradually intensify through our meditation, our ethics, our kshanti, our virya, through our dharma study and reflection, and through our intensive participation in sangha and friendship. Through puja, through working together, the bodhicitta will grow and thrive in the world. And I'm going to end with something that Subhuti wrote as a conclusion to a puja, which he called the Refuge Puja, which is a kind of, a lot of people haven't got on with this puja very well, but he wanted to kind of describe the order's practice in the form of a puja. Well, this is the last section, and this will end our series of talks. through our faith and practice, through our study and reflection, through our love and friendship, through our work and effort, may we burst the bonds of self, may we attain the non-dual mind. May all my brothers and sisters attain that glorious state, so we are joined in perfect harmony. May the bodhicitta arise within our order. May we together become the bodhisattva, a transcendental power loose in the world, wisdom and compassion unleashed, incarnate in us. May our work be for the good of all. May all benefit from what we do. By the bodhisattva's play, manifesting through our order, may all beings worship the Buddhas. May all practice the Dharma. May all join the Sangha. May all the limitless beings in the vastness of space and time reach perfect Buddhahood.